You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in today for Gemma Gaudette. And it's Friday. That means it's time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on all the news, or at least as much as we can, that made headlines this past week. Today, our panel includes Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, and Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com. Hello and happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Yay. All right, let's jump in. Scott, there was a protest this week at St. Luke's in downtown Boise. It caused the hospital to go on lockdown for at least 90 minutes. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah, so a judge ruled this week that a 10-month-old Meridian boy who's been at the center of controversy all week will remain in state custody over health concerns for the baby. So a little bit of background briefly, the boy was taken into custody last weekend over concerns that the boy was in imminent danger over his health. The baby was reportedly underweight and struggling to digest food. The boy's family had canceled a doctor's appointment on Friday of last week. And later that day, the parents did not take the boy to a welfare appointment that an Idaho social worker had requested that they go to. So that set off an effort to locate the baby, which police did on Friday night when they took the baby into state care and to the hospital after determining the baby was in imminent danger of serious harm due to weight loss. Well, as it turns out, the baby is the grandson of Diego Rodriguez, who is head of the Freedom Man Political Action Committee, a supporter of Ammon Bundy, and a great friend to the so-called freedom movement in Idaho, especially the health freedom cause. So in fact, Ammon Bundy, who's running for governor, was arrested early Saturday morning at St. Luke's Meridian after he demanded that the boy be released. Taking the boy into custody was labeled by the family and their supporters as an act of medical kidnapping and medical tyranny, among other accusations. And then since Saturday, protesters have gathered daily at St. Luke's Medical Center. Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan has gotten involved, asked the governor to intervene. Some state legislators have even gotten involved on behalf of the family. The protest came to a head on Tuesday, like you said, at the St. Luke's facility in Boise. In kind of a bizarre twist, Ammon Bundy was at the Ada County Courthouse just down the street on trial for trespassing at the Idaho Capitol building last year. And from the courthouse on Tuesday, Bundy called on his followers to descend upon the St. Luke's Medical Center in Boise, calling it an emergency over the baby. Dozens, if not hundreds of people showed up to the hospital, and the hospital had to pause emergency department services during a one-hour lockdown. They were concerned about public safety. People flooded the phone lines with phone calls. At least four patients had to be transported elsewhere. And in the middle of all this was what's called a shelter care custody hearing to determine whether the baby would be returned to the family or whether the baby would remain in state custody. After that hearing concluded, it was announced that the boy would not be returned to his parents, but would remain in state custody for the time being. The family has vowed to continue to fight the case. The family said they are scheduled for another hearing on April 8th to determine whether to keep the boy in foster care or return him to the family. As of this recording, at noon on Friday, the family was planning another press conference rally Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock. And Rodriguez said he will announce plans for a very large event. We're now learning as we're speaking that Ammon Bundy is calling for a protest at the home of the judge in the case on Saturday. So this promises just to get worse. And again, we're seeing this, this rising level of anger and vitriol at these protests, that when people don't get their way, they turn to threats and bullying and harassment, which is just, it's not good for anybody. And it's just not going to end well. We're just going down a really dangerous path. But that's, you know, it seems like at, as of this recording, that's where we're headed to another conflict tomorrow morning.
Well, it's become very political, obviously, which should be a concern about a child's welfare and parents' rights, however you want to break that down, has become very political. But let's talk a minute about the protest at St. Luke's, because last night there was a statement in my inbox from St. Luke's, and it said during the lockdown, St. Luke's told everyone, including patients, don't come to the hospital. And some people, as you said, including one child that we know of, couldn't get in to get emergency care that they needed.
Right. And it's one thing to protest. It's another thing to disrupt medical care for others. And again, this is stomping your feet, and it crosses the line of infringing on the rights of others. And so protesting is one thing, but when you're interfering with the rights of others, that's another thing.
And you mentioned the phone calls, which I don't think we've heard that much about, because the statement also said that St. Luke's has been flooded with these phone calls, I'm guessing from the protesters, and that's keeping patients from getting a hold of their doctors and causing all kinds of havoc.
Right, same thing. It's infringing on the rights of others by flooding the, and it's being done disruptively. It's being done to disrupt for that very purpose. And when you're talking about medical care, that really crosses a line. And again, now we're talking about going to a judge's house, to protest a judge's decision. This is just getting into dangerous territory.
Something else to add here is that there was a statement earlier this week from Sheriff Matt Clifford asking people who are upset about the case to stop calling the 911 dispatch center and the Ada County Sheriff's Office record clerks. So this effort to essentially infiltrate, not infiltrate, overwhelm the bureaucracy with these complaints, it can be disruptive, especially when 911 calls. You might have to be put on hold or something like that. It's another level, I think, than we've seen before.
Well, I think that's a good point. When you talk about these phone calls to overwhelm St. Luke's, I mean, the hospitals, when a child is brought to them for care, just care for the child. They're not directly involved in, who controls the future of the child. They're just taking care of the kid. So it seems counterproductive to protest at the hospital or
And I think,
at the
yeah, and I,
911 centers.
right. And I think another point too here is that the family is framing the narrative. So they're giving their side of the story, which they should. But the police and Child Protective Services, Health and Welfare, St. Luke's, they're really not able to talk about the details of this case. So really, we are getting just one side of the story, and we don't know what is going on. And taking custody away from parents is not done lightly. It's a serious matter, and there is a process involved where all sides are given their due, and that's what happened in this case. And they just don't like the decision that they came to, which we've seen play out before.
And to talk too about kind of the politicization of this all, when Lieutenant Governor Jess McGeehan jumped into a news conference on Thursday afternoon, she began with a 2-minute prayer about the baby Cyrus case, praying for a miracle to intervene and resolve this dispute. So obviously, this has become a very, political matter as we head into the primary.
And all of the politicalization doesn't help the child, or the hospital, or the 911 folks using 911, or any of that. Wow! And as you said, Scott, more to come. So, speaking of protests, let's stick with protests this week, Margaret. There was a development this week over the tent protests. These are tents that are sitting on the lawn across from the Idaho State House. Tell us about this new lawsuit prompted by Governor Brad Little.
So this has been a growing political flashpoint. There's a group of protesters. Some of them are people who are in the homeless community, some of them are not. And they have set up tents on the lawn on the Capitol Annex near the former Ada County Courthouse. And they've been there since mid-January. And to some people see this protest as a way to call out Idaho and the city of Boise for not providing enough shelter options for, particularly for chronically homeless people who are LGBT. They don't want to conform to religious requirements at the city's largest shelter, the Boise Rescue Mission, and there's a need for more resources. Other folks say that the encampment is a political stunt. Even Boise Mayor Lorne McLean called it staged. And the right wing says that it, or not the right wing, you know, but Republican legislators and even, you know, some moderates are saying, okay, we need to get rid of this protest because it is destroying public property. And the folks there have resources and they've, you know, turned away those resources. And so there's been complaints about trash. There's been complaints about, you know, illegal camping and drug paraphernalia seized, human waste being around because people are camping in the area. And so this week, Governor Brad Little filed a lawsuit in order to remove the protesters. And so we'll see what happens with this. And there's a lot of moving legal parts because according to a 2011 court case from that goes back to Occupy Boise, folks can set up tents on in the Capitol state property, the Capitol annex, for political purposes. But what they cannot do is camp there. So you can't cook food, you can't sleep there, all these sorts of things, but you can have your protest and have a symbolic, your tents as part of the First Amendment. So that is something that a court has found. But then there's also the Martin v. Boise case, which is a very notorious case that got decided by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that found that it's cruel and unusual punishment to ticket someone for sleeping outside when there isn't an appropriate shelter option. And so this court case is going to be very interesting because it's going to hinge on a couple of major questions, which is one, are the protesters camping there? And Idaho State Police has raided the encampment several times and collected bedding, heaters inside tents, propane, all sorts of materials that suggest that people are camping at the site. So ISP says that their folks are camping there. And the other question that's this is going to hinge on is, do the people who are camping there have an appropriate shelter to go to? And I think that right now, that's going to be a major question, especially as things are getting warmer and the shelters, particularly Interfaith Sanctuary, that is a low barrier shelter, has fewer rules and regulations and does not have the religious policy that Boise Rescue Mission does, might have more room now. And so they might not be protected by that Martin v. Boise finding, because it's important to note, it says it's cruel and unusual to ticket someone if they don't have anywhere else to go. So the question is not, are these people experiencing homelessness and camping? When the question is, do they not have another place to go? And so I'm going to be very interested to see where this case goes. The last thing that I want to note that's kind of an interesting wrinkle is that the lawsuit named this group Boise Mutual Aid as the organizer of the protest. But Boise Mutual Aid doesn't see it that way. They see themselves as a facilitator and a supporter of the homeless community having the protest. Whereas, you know, but Boise Mutual Aid, they have been raising money since 2020 to give people who live outside tents and camping supplies and food. And so I think that's going to be another thing that the court's going to have to decide is, what does it mean to organize a protest? And what role did these various organizations and people who are experiencing homelessness have in what has happened?
This sounds just complex enough to be another variation of, you said, of the Martin v. Boise case going up the judicial chain, not stopping at whatever result comes up. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, we're going to see what happens. I think it's important to note that lawsuits are expensive. They are not cheap. And the reason that the Martin v. Boise case went as far as it did is because that case was backed by Legal Aid, which is a nonprofit that helps low-income people with representation in court. And so they had the backing of a nonprofit who was willing to take it all the way. And then also there's the city of Boise, who they have money and they wanted to take it all the way to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So, but in this situation, we don't know yet what legal counsel the Boise Mutual Aid Group and the homeless community has backing them. I think that that's going to give us an indication, because if they have to pay for a private lawyer out of their own pockets, I don't know how far that case is going to go, purely because appealing and appealing and appealing is not a cheap endeavor. But if they end up getting the backing of a nonprofit or some other group to support their case, then I think that this could be a case that goes, that turns into a big fight. There's so many legal questions, and I've been seeing a lot of people batting this around on social media saying, well, the Martin v. Boise case says that they can't be removed. And it's more nuanced than that. And that's what that settlement that Boise entered into last year found, is that there should be the ability to ticket people for sleeping outside, but not in every situation. And I think that the judge is going to have a very interesting time trying to decide how all of these competing factors and the difference between some people engaging in this protest are experiencing homelessness, some of them are not. And I think that question is going to weigh heavily on what this looks like.
Interesting. Kevin, before we talk about all-day kindergarten, I'm going to ask you to insert a shameless plug here and tell us what's on your podcast this week, because I think this is something a lot of people will be interested in.
Oh, sure. I'm always happy to shamelessly plug my podcast. Sherry Barra, the state superintendent, is my guest this week. We're interviewing candidates in the contested primaries. So we spoke to Barra about her 7 years in office, what she hopes to do in the next 4 years. We had interviewed Debbie Critchfield, one of the other Republican candidates for state superintendent. You can find that in our podcast archives. We're efforting to get Brandon Durst on, the third Republican in that primary. He's not yet agreed to an appearance. If we get him, we'll have him on.
Very good. Okay. All day kindergarten. It had quite a ride this week in the Idaho legislature, and it's still stuck in the House at last word. What would this bill actually do?
Right. I think that's part of the reason that this bill is in limbo. So we call it an all-day kindergarten bill because it's designed to provide enough funding to allow many more school districts, maybe every school district, if they chose to go to all-day kindergarten, because the state only pays for a half a day of kindergarten. The schools that are providing all-day kinder, and there are a lot of them, I mean, West Ada, Boise, among others, they have to figure out other ways to pay for all-day kinder, and that can be supplemental property tax levies, that can be tuition and fees the parents have to cough up. It can be some of the literacy money that the state is already giving to schools. This would greatly increase the money that goes into literacy. It would go from $26 million to $72 million that goes to schools for literacy programs. They don't have to spend the money on all-day kindergarten, and that, I think, is one of the sticking points that we're seeing as the House debates this bill. So what happened on Wednesday? The bill came up for a vote. It has already passed the Senate fairly easily. It came up on the House floor. About 20 minutes into the debate, the House went at ease. There was a huddle off, kind of an offline huddle, and the House came back into session. Majority Leader Mike Moyle made a motion to put the bill on hold until Friday. Nobody objected, so there's no vote. Well, Friday morning has come and gone, and there was no vote on the House floor on the kindergarten bill, the literacy bill, again Friday morning. Now, as we speak, it's 12:28. The House is still in session. A House committee is supposed to go in any minute, as soon as the House goes out of session, to look at another proposal on the all-day kindergarten literacy front. I have no idea what that bill is what that bill would do, what that bill would entail. So if you're listening to us live, I'm not being very helpful. If you're listening to the 8 o'clock rebroadcast, we'll have more details by then. But so it's really pretty much up in the air. And I think part of it is confusion about, is this a mandatory kindergarten bill? No. Does this require parents to send their kids to all-day kinder? No. It allows the possibility for all-day kindergarten if districts or charter schools want to go down that road, and if parents want to enroll their children in all-day kinder.
You said there was a huddle, and legislative watchers know anytime there's a off mic huddle that's probably not a good thing for at least some of the people in the legislature. Why the stoppage? Did they not think they had enough votes? Do we know?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. You know, after the House adjourned for the morning, I went up to House Speaker Scott Baidke and I said, you know, what happened there? And was the bill in trouble? And he said, yes, I think it was in trouble. So the fact that they did that on Wednesday and the fact that here we are on Friday, there was no vote, the earliest it could come up now on the House floor would be Monday. That suggests to you that it is still very much in negotiation. I think part of it is that question of, is this a mandatory all-day kindergarten bill? How will this affect property taxes? I think there are probably legislators who really want more assurance that if the state funds all-day kindergarten, patrons around the state will see a break in property taxes because school districts will not have to go to voters for supplemental property tax levies to help pay for all-day kindergarten. That supporters say that is what would kind of organically happen if the state funds all-day kindergarten. I think you've got legislators, especially on the House side, who want something more ironclad than that.
Well, and Margaret, you had mentioned offline a few things that I hadn't necessarily thought about with this debate.
Yeah, so the discussions about early childhood education are obviously very important for literacy and very important for just development. And there's a lot of studies that say that people do, you know, kids do better if they're going to have that early childhood education. But it also has big implications for the economy, because right now there's a big childcare shortage. People are paying more money than their rent for childcare in a lot of cases. And then whenever kids get to that school age, I think there's a lot of parents who say, okay, we're getting there. They're five now. They can go to kindergarten and I can go back to work and we can get some extra money to help pay our rent, because a lot of families have to have two working parents now to cover cost of living, particularly in the Treasure Valley. But then, you know, in a lot of places in Idaho, without this full day kindergarten option, they either have to pay tuition to have their child go to full day kindergarten, or they just don't have the option. And then that turns into another year of either paying exorbitant childcare costs, or one parent stays home with the child. And that's one less parent who can go work. And right now, at a time where there are more job openings than there are workers, that adds up. And I think that this conversation it's important to think about it, not just in the case of what we're doing for education, but how that changes the trajectory of a family, and or it potentially frees up funds to, you know, keep a family from being underwater on their rent or struggling to pay other cost of living. There's just all sorts of levers that this pulls. And once you have a family that can send a kid to all day kindergarten where they can be cared for and have learning and all sorts of things, it changes their budget in a way that is often positive.
And Kevin, how much of the push to get all day K this year is coming from the governor? We know Brad Little is a big supporter of childhood education, childhood literacy.
Well, we know that this is one of his big priorities for K-12 this year, and we know that he's been involved in the back and forth with legislators that has led to this bill. And more or less this bill, and like I say, it passed the Senate easily a few days ago before it's kind of run into this roadblock in the House. This bill would more or less do what Governor Little has been saying that he wants to do with early literacy and all-day kindergarten all along. He's wanted some sort of a mechanism that provides funding for schools to do all-day kindergarten, if that's the route that they want to take, to help get their young kids reading at grade level. So, you know, they can go with kindergarten, they can go with summer school, they can go with, they can use the money for curriculum, they can use it for teacher training, literacy coaches, you name it. He has basically said for years, look, we'll give you the money, you guys figure out how to spend it, you guys figure out what works best in your communities. I don't think the governor wanted to go with some mandatory all-day kindergarten bill. And when you look at some of the resistance that seems to be coalescing in the House about whether this is mandatory all-day kindergarten or not, you can kind of see maybe his political calculus here that it would be hard to get an all-day kindergarten, a mandatory all-day kindergarten bill through the House.
Margaret, I want to talk about a couple of stories you wrote this week relating to the city of Boise's response to the lack of affordable housing, although some might not think those are connected. Let's start with the city buying a $3 million mobile home park on the Boise bench. What's up with this?
So there's still a lot of details we don't have yet. The city has not decided they're going to do this. They have only said that they're considering it. So they voted on Tuesday night to start the due diligence process to look into buying this park. It has about two dozen mobile homes on it, and they look like they're aging. It's definitely probably a place where low-income residents live. And so the intent behind purchases like this would be, you know, city council members called it immediate affordable housing. And essentially, you know, it would preserve this housing for the residents. The city, you know, I asked the city to talk about it. They told me they weren't really willing to do interviews until the due diligence process is up. So there's still a lot of specifics we don't have yet. But this park would, if it's purchased, would go under the management of the city's housing and community development department, which already manages over 200 units of affordable housing for the city. So there is infrastructure to be a landlord. The only city council member who voted against it was city council member Lucy Willits. She said that she thought that the city buying more property would take things off the property tax rolls and shift property tax burden onto other folks. And, you know, she just didn't approve of the city also in her words, becoming a landlord, even though, like I said, the city already is a landlord. So, and she was the lone vote against it. Other council members pointed out that, you know, buying small properties, I think it's only a few acres, really, it has such a minor shift on the property tax issue, the property tax burden onto homeowners. And instead, the change for property tax reform needs to come from the legislature and their work to, you know, and to reform the property tax formula. And so you don't want me to get into that, because then we're going to be here for 5 hours about how that works. But, you know, so we're going to see what's going to happen with this purchase. And it speaks a lot to Mayor McLean's new affordable housing goals that she rolled out last year, saying that they don't want to just build a lot of units of affordable housing. They also want to preserve existing affordable housing. And that is something that a lot of advocates have talked about in recent years, because it's so much cheaper for the government to preserve housing that's affordable that already exists instead of building new stuff, because construction is so expensive. And so we'll see what happens with this.
And the other story that has some ties to the lack of affordable housing is the one you wrote on the Boise City Council requiring short-term rental licenses, which translates out for me to Airbnb and others like it. So what's the story here?
So this has been a long, long, long process to get to this point. This ordinance, what it does is it requires short-term rentals to have a license where you pay $80 a year. You have to have a fire extinguisher, carbon monoxide monitoring. You have to tell the city who owns the property and give a contact information for a local agent who lives in the area to respond to an issue. All sorts of things. Right now, the city, you know, doesn't really have that information. And so, you know, Mayor McLean pushed for this ordinance. She wanted to say, we need to license these short-term rentals, and we need more information about how many of them there are, where they are, and who owns them. So short-term rentals are very controversial in the city. They're, you know, people have fallen one of two sides. There's a lot of folks, including the Boise Regional Realtors, all sorts of other groups, that say this is a violation of private property rights. You know, people should, if you want to own a property and rent it out on Airbnb, you should be able to do that without the government requiring a license or intervening in any way. And they're frustrated by this. They feel targeted, and they're concerned that this could lead to further regulations like what other cities do. I think Sandpoint does this, where they limit short-term rentals to certain specific zones. So there's that fear in that community. Then on the other side, there's people who really hate short-term rentals in neighborhoods. They don't like that they have no idea who's going to be coming in and out of their neighborhood on a daily basis. They're worried about parties. They're worried about disruptive parking, all sorts of problems. And there's also concern. So there's that neighborhood quality of life issue. And they were, you know, those folks were saying that these are commercial businesses operating in neighborhoods. We need to license them. And then there's the other group of people who frankly are concerned that short-term rentals take away long-term rentals, what could be a long-term rental, out of the market. And then by constricting the supply, all it does is drive rents up. You know, there's been a lot of examples where people have posted really cute Airbnbs that are for rent over in the North End, where someone says, yeah, I used to rent this house for $600 a month 5 years ago. And now no one can live there because it's a vacation rental. So there was, you know, there's all sorts of really complex feelings on this. And because of that, this has been a years long conversation about how to address short-term rentals. And finally, Mayor McLean decided to introduce an ordinance and just go for a vote. And it passed. The only two council members who opposed it were City Councilmember Bajan and City Councilmember Lucy Willits. And they were just concerned, you know, they felt like the ordinance didn't accomplish what it, you know, it wouldn't accomplish enough to warrant the extra red tape, essentially. And so City Council is going to be revisiting this in a year. And I think everyone is going to be interested to see what those numbers look like of how many short-term rentals there are, where they are, and if there are any numbers based on how many of them are investor-owned and how many of them are locally owned. And that's going to be another thing to watch coming up.
Wow. Okay, yeah, definitely. And let's switch gears with higher ed budgeting. Kevin, the higher ed budget passed the House rather easily this week, surprisingly. Despite your rather dire predictions, it was going to be pretty ugly. What's in the budget, and why were you concerned that it might not be so easy to pass?
Well, now, in fairness, other folks, like legislators, were saying that this bill was going to be in trouble, or if it was going to pass, it was going to be very, very close. So what happened on Wednesday was that the higher ed budget passed. And you're right, it was a 46-22 vote. So it wasn't even a squeaker. And a majority of Republicans voted for this budget, which I found very surprising. And then I look at that roll call, I see some rather conservative Republicans vote for it. So here's the crux of the budget. So we're talking about a $25 million increase in general fund dollars for higher education. That's the tax dollars. That's not tuition and fees. That's what you pay in your sales taxes and your income taxes that goes to higher education. I think, as best as I can do the research, it's probably the biggest dollar for dollar increase that higher education has ever received in state history. And a couple of really important components in this budget: it will give a 5% pay increase to every employee on the college and university campuses, or it gives a 5% increase in the pay scale. I mean, it's not across the board 5%, but it puts that kind of money into pay raises, and it does it in this budget with the tax dollars. So what that means is that the colleges and universities are not going to have to use tuition and fees to cover pay raises, which means that they're saying that they're going to be able to freeze tuition for undergraduates, for in-state undergraduate students, for one more year. It'd be the third consecutive year of that tuition freeze. And that was one of the big arguments on the House floor, saying if we pass this budget, we're going to shield students from what amounts to a tax increase. I mean, what's tantamount to a tax increase? If you force students to have to pay more for their tuition, that's an increase in their expenses at a time, obviously, of high inflation for everybody. You did have some pushback on the critical race theory, on the indoctrination issue, as we've seen on the House floor in past years, but it really just did not seem to have the same kind of momentum. So it was a big victory, I think, for the higher education lobby, who had pushed hard to try to get this budget through. I think it's a big setback for social conservatives on the House floor and the Idaho Freedom Foundation, which has been the leading opponent of the political bent of higher education. They've been leading the charge on critical race theory and indoctrination and trying to get legislators to defund higher education. And we saw the nexus between those legislators and the Freedom Foundation a couple of weeks ago when Ron Nate, Republican from Rexburg, one of the most conservative members of the legislature, tried to cut the higher education budget in the budget committee. And he read word for word and used dollar for dollar figures from a Freedom Foundation article on higher education that was published 2 days before the budget hearing. So a very clear nexus there between what the Freedom Foundation is saying about higher education and what one legislator was saying about higher education. But in the end, lawmakers decided, you know, that this budget was a good one. It was one that would, you know, keep the colleges and universities moving and allow them to hold the line on tuition. So passes the House easily. It goes to the Senate. I will safely predict that it should have no trouble getting through the Senate. The Senate has been pretty sympathetic to higher education in past sessions. So it would be absolutely shocking if this budget ran into trouble on the Senate side.
Scott, Meta is going to build a data center in CUNA. For those of you who are like me, who can't make the switch, Meta is Facebook, more or less. Scott, what is a data center and why is Meta building one in CUNA?
Well, so these data centers are the servers that store the data for all the traffic that you see on their various apps, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. And they need cooling. They heat up, and anybody's been in a computer room in your office, you know that it has to be cooled. And one of the big concerns about these data centers, and this data center is about 1 million square feet, so a good size data center. And one of the big concerns about these data centers is that they use a lot of water to cool down the servers, and or to keep the centers themselves cool. Some estimates at 3 to 5 million gallons a day, which is about a city of the size of CUNA to Caldwell. Some estimates for a data center this size were about 1 million gallons a day. I spoke with one data center expert who said something like this could be 500,000 gallons a day. So I wanted to find out exactly how many gallons a day of water this data center was going to use and where those water rights were going to come from, because there were no water rights applications with the Idaho Department of Water Resources. So I reached out to Meta, and the spokesperson said that they expect this data center to use about 70,000 gallons a day, which is a lot less than most estimates. They say that they're going to use the cooler climate in CUNA for about half of the year to keep for the cooling needs of the data center for about half of the year, which will cut down on its water use. So 70,000 gallons per day on average over the course of a year. So I went and I looked at their water rights, because in Idaho, water rights follow the land. So they purchased 4 parcels of land for a total of about 485 acres. And with those parcels of land come water rights. And so I looked at the water rights that are associated with those parcels, and they have rights to about 12.6 cubic feet per second, which is about 6.8 million gallons per day. So they have water rights for almost 7 million gallons a day, which is a lot more than they need. Not all of that water right is available for commercial and industrial. Some of it is irrigation. Some of it is even stock water rights. But even with just the commercial and industrial, they have about 5.4 CFS, cubic feet per second, which is about 3 million gallons per day. So when I started looking at that, and 70,000 gallons a day for this data center, and I did the math on it, and 1 million square feet for a data center is about 22 acres. And if you include a parking lot and maybe some landscaping, let's just say 30 acres, maybe it's takes up 30 acres of space. So they purchased 485 acres. They have at least 3.2 CFS or 5.4 CFS of water available, and plan to use just 70,000 gallons of water a day for one data center. I suspect that this may be the first of possibly many data centers to go into this site. There are other places like Prineville has 9 data centers in one location, and they're adding 2 more. Altoona, Iowa has several data centers in one location. So I suspect that based on the water rights and the land area that they've purchased, we might actually see a few more Meta data centers go in this industrial park in CUNA.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing. Okay, in the 2.5 minutes we have left, Kevin, please break down all of the legislative races that are coming up.
All 105 of them. Okay, well, let's go.
Okay, so no, you wrote about the top 10 and then the top 20, I think, races basically to watch.
Yeah. And I'll give you an overview even from that sense. I mean, we're going to see so much turnover in the legislature, Samantha. I mean, we've had key legislators already retire, chair people of, you know, the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, the House Health and Welfare Committee, Senate State Affairs Committee. We also have redistricting, and that's going to force several incumbents to run against each other. And that's one of the things I break down in my piece on Thursday. And you just have a lot of reshuffling because you've got 9 members of the House wanting to move over to the Senate. You have, you know, legislators running for statewide office. So you will have at least 3 dozen new legislators next year, no matter what. I mean, that's if you have like chalk elections where you have no upsets, no incumbents losing. And we know that'll probably happen as well. So you're going to have a lot of new faces. And what I tried to do with this piece is kind of point out some of the races from the Panhandle through Eastern Idaho that will really have an effect on the tone of the session, on the politics of the session. You know, primaries where you have maybe a more moderate candidate and a more hardline conservative candidate, those kind of races that can really tip the balance of power in the House or the Senate. And, you know, that balance of power that, you know, we were talking about last segment with the higher education budget. I mean, a few votes here or there, a few elections that go one way or the other could really affect the way the House or the Senate or both deal with legislation in 2023. It's going to be a fascinating legislative election year on top of all of the statewide races that we're paying attention to. So if you like politics, this is your year.
Well, and it's not just a matter of a few votes here or there, depending on whether, you know, you get moderate or more hardcore in the party line. But we're talking about, in your article, some very key people in the legislature who are facing other very key people now in the legislature, thanks to redistricting.
And I'll just focus on one because it's so important in the education space. Stephen Thane, who's the chairman of the Senate Education Committee, he's running against C. Scott Groh, who's a Republican from Eagle, who sits on the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee. Redistricting put those two senators together. They're running against each other. And the other thing is really interesting about this really quickly, Thane's district changed almost entirely with redistricting. I mean, he lives in Emmett. His district used to run into Lemhi County and Custer County all through central Idaho. Well, he doesn't represent those voters anymore. He's in a district that's Gem County and Eagle and parts of Ada County. It's almost like he's running in an entirely different legislative district. So that, you know, he's almost like he's running like a newcomer practically.
Yeah, it's going to be crazy. My thanks to the Reporter Roundtable this week. Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, Scott McIntosh with the Idaho Statesman, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com. Check out their reporting online. Thank you for joining us. Our executive producers are Paul Stribling and Tom Michael, and our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jemma Gaudette.